This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, owner and user of Mint Mobile. And I am recording this message on my phone. I'm literally on my Mint phone. Why? Because fancy recording studios cost money. And if we spent money on things like that, we couldn't offer you screaming deals. Like if you sign up now for 3 months, you get 3 months free on every one of your plans, even unlimited. Visit mintmobile.com/switch.
Limited time, new customer offer. Activate within 45 days. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. Unlimited customers using more than 40 gigabytes per month will experience lower speeds. Video streams at 480p. See mintmobile.com for details.
At age 30, Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart is at a crossroads in his life. The aristocracy of snobby Salzburg have turned their noses up at the composer, and the archbishop dismisses Mozart from his position with a kick in the butt. He escapes to Prague. The second his carriage drives through the city gates, Mozart overhears a young boy whistle the melody of his very own Figaro. This Mozart mania opens all his creative valves. The scores flow out like beer from the taps of the city taverns. Practice made Mozart a virtuoso. Vitality made him the creator of Don Giovanni, the opera of all operas. The poet Lorenzo da Ponte composed its lyrics from the hotel opposite, sending them to Mozart's desk via paper airplane. Well, workation has always been a good idea. How about a trip to Prague?
Book a workation now with the airlines of the Lufthansa Group.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hi there, this is Claudia Hammond. Welcome to All in the Mind, the BBC Radio 4 podcast, where we look at psychology, neuroscience and mental health. What would you do if you knew that something very bad was happening where you work? Something that could even put people in danger. Would you report it to the big boss? And what if they took no notice? Would you blow the whistle? Now, this probably sounds like the right thing to do, the moral thing to do. Why then do so many whistleblowers find they're treated badly, even when they've been vindicated and saved lives? The psychology of whistleblowing later on. And my guest today is Daryl O'Connor, who is Professor of Psychology at the University of Leeds. Let me ask you something. Have you watched the news much recently, Daryl?
Yes, I have. And as we all know, it's been pretty distressing and graphic. And let's hope for brighter times ahead.
Yes, with Israel, Gaza and Ukraine, not to mention climate change and the cost of living crisis, it can feel as though there's nothing but bad news at the moment. Now, lots of people have been telling me that they're not engaging with it anymore because it's making them so unhappy. And this is borne out by recent figures from the news agency Reuters, suggesting that in the UK, as many as 41% of people are now avoiding the news. So I thought we'd have a look at the psychological impact that the news can have on us, and whether there's a way of keeping informed about important events in the world without feeling too helpless. So we brought together a leading psychologist in this field, Professor Roxanne Cohen-Silver from the University of California, Irvine in the US, with Mike Clements, who is Associate Director of Trends and Futures at Ipsos UK. Now, in their report, Global Trends 2023, they say we're living through what they call a polycrisis. I asked Mike what that means.
It's a really interesting turn of phrase, I think. And I think what it really is a useful way to think about the challenges facing the world. It suggests that we don't face a set of distinct problems, but rather an interlinked network of challenges where each part can magnify the impact of the others. And that means that the whole is more than the sum of its parts and increases the likelihood of sudden and chaotic shifts, which form a lot of the bad news you might be reading about at the moment.
And you've done a survey of more than 24,000 people in 31 different countries. And what effect are you seeing this polycrisis having on us?
So I think there's a few different effects. We often find people are quite pessimistic, particularly in Europe and the US. That isn't new. But what I do think we see is perhaps a growth in interest in nostalgia. Looking to Britain, we're quite a nostalgic country by nature, actually, and we've measured levels of nostalgia for a couple of decades, and they're normally quite high and quite steady. But some other countries such as Germany, Sweden and China, we've seen quite big increases in people wishing their country could be the way it used to be, which is quite new. And we date a lot of it from the pandemic onwards.
And yet I was interested to see that in a separate recent poll that you've done, people in the UK are feeling more optimistic about themselves, say, than the wider world. And in your What Worries the World survey, actually war came 12th on the list, which is interesting because you see that a lot. What are the top things people are worrying about?
They're often, much like our optimism, matters that are much closer to home. So obviously the cost of living crisis and inflation has been the top issue for quite a long time. And in Britain particularly, we also worry about the health service. So thinking about our own and our family's health. We've done some other recent polling where we found people are quite strongly optimistic about their own life, about their friendships and their families. And then there's quite a marked contrast when we ask people how optimistic they are about the country and about the world overall. That's much, much lower.
And I'm guessing these findings might not be that surprising to you, Roxy, that people are feeling perhaps pessimistic about the world. And you've studied the impact that the exposure to traumatic events through watching media about it, so maybe watching videos online or watching TV or listening to the radio, can have. And you did a big study in the aftermath of the Boston Marathon bombings. What did you find there?
We actually began our investigation of the psychological consequences of media exposure to traumatic events after the September 11th, 2001 terrorist attack, where we saw that people who engaged or watched more television in the days after the 9/11 attacks were more likely to exhibit physical and mental health symptoms over time. After the Boston Marathon bombing, we recognized that people got their news from far more than television. And we again found that the combined exposure across all forms of media, both traditional and social, was associated with increased acute stress symptomatology in the days after the Boston Marathon bombing and again over time.
What seems almost unbelievable in your research is that watching a lot of footage could actually cause higher levels of acute stress than being there at the Boston Marathon bombing, which just seems incredible. How much were people watching?
Well, on average, people were engaging in about 4.5 hours a day of combined exposure. That doesn't mean that people are sitting in front of their computer for 4.5 hours straight, although, of course, some may do that. But what is much more likely is that people are exposed in snippets throughout the day, maybe getting news alerts on their phones. And so this combined exposure really does add up. And we found that individuals who spent more than 4 hours a day of exposure were more likely to be exhibiting acute stress than actually those who were at the site of the bombing.
Were you surprised when you got that result?
To be honest, we were flabbergasted. We had no idea that those findings would emerge. And we think that when you are at an event, there's a beginning and there's a middle and there's an end. And then people either walk away or are carried away. But with media exposure, it loops over and over again. There's really no end point. And people are exposed repeatedly, often to graphic or gruesome images. And those are not what people may be seeing when they're actually at the site of a tragedy.
And can people almost get stuck in a kind of, I don't know, sort of cycle of worrying where they watch something, then they worry about it, and then they almost look for some more of it to watch?
That's exactly what we found. We were able to follow several thousand people from the days after the Boston Marathon bombing for 3 years. 3 years later, we had another mass tragedy in the United States. It was the Pulse nightclub shooting, a massacre that took place in Orlando, Florida, where almost 50 people were killed and over 50 people were gravely injured. And we found that those individuals who were immersed in more media in the days after the Boston Marathon bombing were more worried about mass violence events, more worried about terrorism. And when the next big tragedy occurred 3 years later, they were more drawn to engaging in media, a lot of media about the Pulse nightclub shooting. So we see this as a cycle of distress where, exactly as you described, more media leads to or is associated with more stress, more worry, and more worry and more stress is also associated with consuming more media.
So you could think that one thing we could all do is to decide not to watch any news at all. And Mike, journalists will often say news matters even when it's bad because people might take action and they might do something about the bad things that are going on in the world. But I was interested that in your report, you seem to find that people started focusing inwardly instead.
Yes, that's right. I think it often when the world seems quite uncontrollable, focusing inward is perhaps a rational response. And actually moving from concern to behaviour can be quite difficult. Overall, it seems that people would prefer to turn inwards when they feel the world is a bit overloading.
Roxy, do we know whether people are likely to take more or less action if they've been watching difficult news? I don't know. Are they more likely to donate money, perhaps? Or?
We've actually explored this exact issue, and we were able to study how people responded to images of the Ukraine war. We do see that the more graphic and gruesome images continue to be associated with distress, but images about the war that are not very graphic is associated with more action.
And Mike, I was interested to read that you and the other authors on this Ipsos report actually said that you felt an increasing sense of pessimism yourselves as you were writing it. It was kind of making you feel pessimistic.
Yes, even pollsters can feel pessimistic sometimes. I think part of that's our sort of own behavioural biases towards bad news. I think the idea that people find optimism easier close to home is true for all of us. And so thinking about a polycrisis and, you know, a series of insoluble problems that face us, I think can generate a sense of despair. You know, the environment's quite a good example of that, that people are feeling eco-despair as a result. But we've got to focus on poly-solutions, I suppose, in order to overcome the poly-crisis.
Yeah, that's interesting you talk about poly-solutions, because there is a move towards this whole idea of something called solution-focused journalism, where you perhaps show what the solution is to a problem as well as showing the problem. And that's something you see a lot more of now. Roxy, what do you think? Should people not watch the news or watch less of it or choose carefully? What can we actually do about this?
I really don't support any censorship, and I don't support people putting their head in the sand and avoiding news altogether. I think, however, that people may not realize how much bad news they're consuming. In addition, I think one can engage in stories about tragedy in the news without immersing oneself in videos of gruesome and graphic images. I personally avoid graphic images. I don't click on videos.
Yeah, so maybe listening to the radio is one of the answers there, and then you haven't got the pictures. Can I ask you what you do, Mike? Do you have alerts on your phone that tell you the news all day, or have you found a way of coping with watching the news?
I don't actually have any alerts, and much of what the news I do consume is actually through written media, so magazines and even newspapers sometimes, as well as the radio. So perhaps that helps me deal with all of this. But I think that point of control is really important. We found in other work that people who feel happier and more successful feel they have a greater extent of control over their own lives. And so that point on being very aware of what you're doing is definitely something that I think is important.
Mike Clements and Professor Roxy Cohen-Silver. Now, Daryl, isn't one of the problems that we know that anything that is negative just sticks in the mind more, doesn't it? And we notice it and remember it. So that's going to happen with the news.
Yes, you're absolutely right, Claudia. So there's this well-known phenomenon known as negativity bias. And it's, I think it's likely to help us explain this. This is the idea that people have this propensity more likely to attend to, learn from and process negative information, which actually, sadly, could be damaging for them.
And it's even things like if you show people, I don't know, a picture of a crowd of faces and ask them to pick out the one angry face and the one happy face, people can pick out the angry one much faster. I suppose we're primed to notice negative things.
That's exactly it. I mean, it's evolutionarily adaptive. So that's exactly why we think we have this phenomenon. So the idea that whenever it ultimately negativity bias keeps us safe.
So have you taken any steps to reduce your own distress at watching the news, or are you someone who has news alerts on your watch or on your phone?
Sadly, I am one of those individuals who has lots of alerts on one's phone. And actually, one thing I do try and do in order to counter that, because I'm aware of the fact it triggers and impacts on my mood and my emotion, every so often I just switch my phone off, or I actually remove my phone from my person. I'll put it in another room in the house, or I'll remove it from where I am.
And it's difficult, isn't it? Because I mean, I feel guilty just sort of moaning about watching bad news, because obviously it's a million times worse for the people that are involved. And it feels as if we should know what's going on, but it's difficult.
No, I couldn't agree more. I mean, to me, we are living through some of the most horrific and dreadful times in terms of lots of the world events that we're experiencing. And you're right, this is a pinch what we experienced compared to what other people are experiencing right at the coalface.
Now, each week, my guest on All in the Mind brings me a brand new study to discuss. Now, the one you've chosen, Daryl, feels rather apposite because it's on compassion fatigue. So is this the idea that your compassion can run out, if you like?
Yes, it is. It is exactly that. But maybe it's worth just explaining to listeners what is compassion. So compassion is this feeling of concern for others' suffering, so difficult things that they're experiencing. But why it's also important is compassion helps motivate our willingness to help other people. So yeah, so what is really fascinating about this study is that they have investigated whether or not compassion is a limited resource. In other words, do we have beliefs that mean some of us think compassion will lead to fatigue and run out? Or other individuals, do we think it won't run out? And actually, what they actually go on to test here is they try and establish, does this mindset, as they call it, a compassion limited mindset, predict our likelihood to experience fatigue and be less likely to help other people?
So this is from the University of Michigan. What did they have to do with the people who took part in this study?
They came up with a podcast which manipulated individuals' beliefs about whether or not compassion is limited or non-limited. And what they showed afterwards, that individuals who are randomly allocated to what we call the limited mindset condition were significantly more likely to help other people, for example, students, give them feedback on their CVs compared to those in the other condition.
So does this mean, I mean, are they saying that you can just decide that your compassion won't run out and then it won't? That kind of sounds too simple in a way.
Well, it is actually that simple, but of course, I suspect there's a limit to all of this. But the crucial thing is, we know compassion fatigue is linked to lots of negative mental health outcomes, such as burnout, anxiety and depression. So if we can somehow help people by challenging these beliefs that they have, that this is ultimately going to help them and maybe also help us cope with these crazy times that we're living in currently.
Thanks, Daryl. Now, when you hear about wrongdoing on the news, it's often come to light thanks to a whistleblower who's discovered that something very wrong, even something that results in death, has been taking place in their organisation. But even if they've been proved right and stopped more people from coming to harm, whistleblowers can still find themselves shunned and unemployed.
I haven't been able to get a job since then. Financially, I've reached ruin. Because I couldn't find employment for such a long time, I had to release my pension to support my daughter and I. The trauma of what I went through took its toll on my marriage, so subsequently I got divorced. It's been horrible. It's been absolutely horrible, and it's certainly not something that I would wish on anybody.
It was a group of clinicians following a process trying to raise concerns and having our concerns turned on their head. And I think, you know, our experiences aren't uncommon in the NHS, that you go to senior colleagues with a problem and you start to realise that they're seeing you as a problem rather than the concern that you have.
Well, within 30 days, they cut my pay. They took away my support and wouldn't let me open new accounts and essentially tried to make my life miserable. They forced me out. I had $1 million worth of stock, which they withheld. I couldn't find a job at another brokerage firm. The issue is that I had baggage and I couldn't go anywhere else.
Now, I was wondering why whistleblowers are treated like this. And what is it about the psychology of some organisations that makes it so hard for people to raise concerns internally? Now, someone who knows all about this is Amy Edmondson, who's Professor of Leadership and Management at Harvard Business School and author of the new book, Right Kind of Wrong, Why Learning to Fail Can Teach Us to Thrive. We've heard there from three whistleblowers where things really didn't turn out well for them. You know, they found they were shunned or they lost their jobs or that things were turned on them themselves. How common would you say it is for whistleblowers, whether they blow the whistle externally to, you know, the press or regulators or the wider world or even within a company? How commonly are they treated badly for it?
Well, I think you're pointing to a pattern that does exist. So I think it's certainly more common than it should be.
I think it's intriguing that even after people have been proved right, that people still aren't necessarily treated well, that people seem to still not like the whistleblowers, even when it was justified. And, you know, maybe they've saved lives by coming forward. What is it about that, do you think, that we don't like?
You know, I think this is a flaw in our psychology, honestly. The public should be grateful. And the fact that we're not, I think, speaks to a kind of very deep-seated notion that you shouldn't tell tales. If we have a sort of belief that you don't do that, you don't tell tales on your family, your team, your organization, then that would help explain this reaction.
So how can workplaces encourage people to be able to speak up within the organization, to feel that they can come forward and say, you know, there is something that's wrong going on here, there's something that's unethical, or there's something that might be unsafe?
Well, that is exactly the right question. And the answer to that lies in leadership, but leadership at all levels, not just leadership at the top. Leadership that communicates that we are operating in an uncertain, complex, interconnected world. You know, leadership that communicates that things will therefore go wrong, and we will be excellent when we are alert and vigilant and catch and correct things before anything really bad happens.
And in your research, you talk about something called psychological safety. How do you define that?
Psychological safety is a state of believing that your voice is welcome. Psychological safety describes an environment where people know for sure they're supposed to speak up, not just when they see something wrong, but even if they have a vague worry about something.
And of course, if people don't feel they can speak up, things can go very wrong. And in your book, you mentioned the Columbia shuttle disaster in 2003, where 7 people lost their lives. Could that have been a bit different then?
Absolutely. There was an engineer who saw in the after-launch videos a grainy speck that looked to him like it might have been a foam strike. Now, a foam strike is when a piece of the solid rocket booster breaks off at launch. And if it hits the leading edge of the shuttle, it's a more delicate area, there is the possibility of creating very serious damage. It was impossible to see. So it was a highly ambiguous threat. And the engineer did speak up about it to his boss. He was told, it's probably a nothing. Look, foam strikes happen all the time. Don't worry about it. But then there was a crucial meeting where the mission management team leader had an explicit conversation about the foam strike. And in that meeting, that engineer felt absolutely unable to speak up and say, we really don't know enough, right? This, it could be bad. It could be nothing. When asked later to explain, why didn't you speak up? He said, I am too low down in the organization, and she, meaning the mission management team leader, is way up here, which he gestured with his hands. And that is a very fundamental feeling in organizations, that sense that you can't speak up in a hierarchy. And unless it is explicitly overridden by leadership, it can end up silencing the voices of even very real experts.
There can be a desire, though, can't there, amongst some managers to focus on the positive. I've read about, you know, this idea of toxic positivity, where staff are almost not allowed to discuss what's hard about their job because somehow that's seen as sort of letting the side down, that you're not with us.
Yes, and I think that also taps into a kind of a deeper psychological phenomenon where we prefer good news to bad, where we think of being positive in our ways of interacting with each other is a good thing. And maybe that's true. In fact, I would argue it is true for social occasions, but not in the work environment, where the quality and safety of the work depends on our willingness to be candid, to lean in, to tell the truth.
So what can we do to make ourselves better at psychological safety at work? You talk in your book about a doctor who, in a sense, almost sort of trained himself to be better at it.
Yes, Dr. Jonathan Cohen, who's an anesthesiologist at a cancer center here in the United States, he posed the question, you know, how does it feel when someone points out my error? Now, most of us would answer that question like, it doesn't feel good. Just that's pretty natural to not like it when someone says, hey, you're making a mistake there. And so he says he trained himself to equate someone pointing out his error with patients getting safer care. So he said he really taught himself to be glad when someone pointed out his error. And he adds, as almost an afterthought, that it also means he's a good leader, right? It also means he's doing something right with the team in the operating suite.
And how much of a difference has hybrid working and remote working made? Because now people often are in situations where they can't quite see what everyone else is doing so much. And it's hard to just, you can't just have a more subtle conversation about something while you're making a cup of tea. Instead, if you've got to raise something in a meeting, perhaps with lots of people, that's much harder because you might be wrong.
You're absolutely right. And I think we're just in the process of collecting more systematic data on that. And the qualitative data and the evidence from interviews and discussions around the world is that psychological safety and the behavior of speaking up with ambiguous or, you know, unsure issues takes a hit with remote work.
You talk in your book about something called blameless reporting, and in a way that seems like the opposite of whistleblowing, that it can help people to speak up.
Yes, when you have blameless reporting within an organization, then you don't need whistleblowing, because then people know that when they report something that seems off, there will be absolutely no blame attached. Now, some organizations do that with anonymity, others don't. You can make an argument for both, but it's an explicit policy that says speaking up will not be blamed.
And I'm wondering whether there could be any lessons from this for our personal lives too. Have you seen a kind of crossover there?
Yes. And in fact, that's something that I have not done in my prior works, but in my latest book, Right Kind of Wrong, I talk about that throughout the book, how many of these lessons really apply well to parenting. I would argue that in a healthy family dynamic, people have a kind of implicit, maybe explicit, blameless reporting policy. You will never get yelled at by your parents if you say, "Help, I'm in over my head. I need a ride home tonight."
Amy Edmondson. Blameless reporting at home. I like that idea, Daryl.
I think it's a really, really nice idea. And the direct implications for this idea, encourage your children, if you've got children, to actually don't be afraid to speak up and share their concerns. Ultimately, a really nice way forward.
And what else struck you there when it comes to people at work?
What really struck me is this whole issue to do with patient safety. You know, this is a really emerging area. You know, we know the government and lots of other areas are investing lots of cash into understanding factors to do with patient safety. And this is clearly another area which is multifactorial, and we need to do more work in that area.
Now, before we go, you have one more thing for us. And it's kind of on what happens to our bodies when we discuss difficult issues with our partner. It's from Northwestern University in the US. What did they do in this study?
So this is a really nice study. So this is a study which investigated the connections between our physiology, our behaviour and our language use. So it's what's known as a natural emotion language study. So what they did was they brought couples into the lab. They attached them to lots of physiology equipment, so they were able to measure their heart rate and their blood pressure throughout. And then they allocated them either to talk about a conflict situation, about money or in-laws.
Or things they might argue about.
Absolutely. Or alternatively, to talk about nice things, about going on holiday or other nice things in their lives. And then they measured their physiology and response and then counted the number of negative emotion words and positive emotion words. And they showed that under situations where you used high levels of negative emotion words, in particular anger words, this predicted this thing called cardiovascular reactivity. So cardiovascular reactivity is the extent to which your blood pressure elevates in response to a challenging scenario. But what we know is high levels of cardiovascular reactivity can be damaging. But recent evidence has also showed that low levels of cardiovascular reactivity can also be damaging for our health. And this study, what's interesting about it is this shines a torch on how understanding the relationship between our language and this reactivity.
And I guess in a way that all makes sense, doesn't it? Because that's what we know. If you're talking about something that makes you feel cross, then you're going to be more tensed up. And we know that's not good for our bodies, don't we?
Yes. Well, we don't actually know that, Claudia. So there is a whole school of thought which shows that if you express lots of negative emotion, that can really benefit and might be associated with lower physiological responses. Another school of thought shows completely the opposite. What these data show is that high levels of these negative emotion words, particularly anger, are associated with those increased cardiovascular responses.
So bottle it up, keep it in.
Indeed.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Professor Daryl O'Connor from the University of Leeds. Now, I guess now you need to go home, Daryl, and if you think about what we've learned today, it's maybe not using angry words when discussing things with your partner. I'm sure you wouldn't. Be mindful about watching the news and try to be receptive to what people are telling you at work, and to accept that you have more capacity for compassion than you thought. Just those things.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's enough to keep us going, surely.
I think it is. Well, that is all from All in the Mind from the BBC for now. Now, thanks to the producer, Sophie Ormiston, and our studio engineer today, Tim Heffer. In the next episode, what psychologists can learn by studying in minute detail the reactions of terrified contestants on Mastermind. Bye for now.
In 1786, Johann Wolfgang von Goethe suffers from dreadful writer's block, and in the dead of night, he sets off on his Italian journey. Amidst the Pantheon, the all-engulfing scent of lemon trees, and the alluring nude Italian models, his virginity, he loses it in Rome. His creativity, he rediscovers it in creaking Roman beds. His inspiration gushes like the lava of Vesuvius. The result of the young artist's wanderlust, over 800 watercolors and 3 completed plays, cherished for all eternity. Such creative output warrants some downtime. In the cool halls of the Sistine Chapel, Goethe stops for a nap on the throne of Pope Pius VI. Well, workation has always been a good idea. How about a trip to Rome?
Book a workation now with the airlines of the Lufthansa Group.